This is Angle of View. Today is July 7th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Well, shoot, guys, this Spielberg ranking is going to take 3 episodes all on its own. I'm already crushed for time, so let's waste none and plunge right in. Here we go. The 35 films of Steven Spielberg's career ranked from worst to best. Number 35, The Terminal, 2004. Screenplay by Sasha Gervaisi and Jeff Nathanson from a story by Andrew Niccol and Sasha Gervaisi. The one where Tom Hanks is a guy from an imaginary post-Soviet republic that collapses during his flight to the U.S. so that he is stranded in customs limbo in the airport for months on end. The Terminal is an especially bad Hallmark movie. However bad you think it might be, I promise you it's worse. Lots of movies are insulting, but few are insulting on every level for every second. It's impossible even to be happy for Kumar Palana, the older Indian gentleman whom you might remember from early Wes Anderson movies, playing characters with names like Kumar and Mr. Little Jeans. Number 34, War Horse, 2011, screenplay by Lee Hall and Richard Curtis from the novel by Michael Moore Pugo and its stage adaptation written by Nick Stafford. The one about the English country boy in the early 20th century who goes round and round this carousel called life atop the same horse, a handsome stallion named Joey, who eventually carries him right into World War I. This started as a novel, but it became a movie because of the success of the West End play staged more than 20 years later with horse puppets. The horse puppets were considered quite bold by theater critics at the time, but since this is a movie and horses have been a part of movies since the beginning, Spielberg used real horses and fell right into a pit of trite mythic horse movie molasses. The movie is frankly pathetic at the screenplay level, glucose for drips. Every bit of drama and suspense is artificial, every flicker of exposition crude and stupid. It could not be more simplistic, but every story development is underlined 15 times, as though there's no way you could hope to understand any of it on your own. Consequently, the moments that start to get somewhere on the power of the images, because this is still Spielberg we're talking about, are all rapidly and dutifully sunk by the kind of dialogue usually reserved only for the most insulting children's books, the kind that believe that powers of cognition arrive in adulthood. I have not read Michael Moore Pugo's novel, but given that it is not a children's book, it probably does not cop this kind of attitude. I also haven't seen the play, but one thing I'm fairly confident in is that the play is not bursting at the seams with movie cliches. This movie is as thorough a squandering of a fine British cast as if it had all been a commercial for margarine or something. The only way through it is controlled groaning. Spielberg's attraction to this kind of material represents the very worst of him. Number 33, The Post, screenplay by Liz Hanna and Josh Singer, the one about the decision the Washington Post made to publish the Pentagon Papers in 1971. It packs its cast with stars and sweats proudly to make its points about 1, the media's duty to the public, 2, the parallels between Nixon's and Trump's wars on the media and their attempts to control public opinion, and 3, the extra pressure and precarity that the Post's publisher Kay Graham, played here by Meryl Streep, experienced in her difficult position by virtue of being a woman. Yet none of it gets 1 millimeter off the ground. It's almost upsettingly flat and uninvolving. It was sometime in the 2000s that Spielberg's tricks grew stale and automated. Now his movies are no longer even recognizable as his. This could just as easily have been directed by, say, Mike Newell or Mark Forster. Note, I did feel that way in 2017, but, you know, Spielberg came back and made West Side Story and The Fablemans, and those were really good. So all was not lost forever, but The Post remains really bad. Number 32, AI Artificial Intelligence, 2001, screenplay by Steven Spielberg, from a screen story by Ian Watson, from the short story Super Toys Last All Summer Long by Brian Aldiss. An unknown amount of Stanley Kubrick's influence is still to be found in the first drafts of the script. No one will ever know. But this is the one where Haley Joel Osment is a little robot boy who needs a mommy. Speaking as someone who hasn't read the Brian Aldiss source story and also doesn't know much about the tortuous path to the screen that this took through Stanley Kubrick, this movie really feels like Spielberg to me. The schmaltzy Spielberg, the one I can't stand. All the more since he wrote the screenplay, I have to suspect he deserves the primary blame for the fact that this takes a provocative premise. What if someone manufactured a robot child for childless couples and programmed it so that it actually attached to its human parents, and turns it proudly and emphatically into technology Pinocchio without the moral dimensions? I hated this movie passionately at the time of its release, and though I still think it's bad, and believe it gets bad rather early, my hatred back then was mostly from the 11 endings that occupy the final half hour, which infuriated me so much that they poisoned everything that had come before. This time around, knowing in advance that I was going to have to sit through all that, I had an easier time appreciating the first act, which, though it doesn't really sell its family unit, and that is a big problem, is nonetheless well-shaped and beautifully controlled by the sensitive performances of Osment and Francis O'Connor. It's not until Robo Boy David is booted from his home that it becomes a bad movie, because that is when Spielberg begins to discard the potentialities that he seemed to have been coaxing forth. Human society is basically not explored at the level of their moral and philosophical orientation toward mechas, except for a little bit in a scene of child characters at a birthday party, not coincidentally the best scene in the movie. Adult society never learns about David. He's a secret prototype, and his human family are corporate test subjects, and is never really seen engaging with the idea of a surrogate robot child. The test couple that takes the prototype David have a child in a coma, which is hardly a target market for the product, and the flesh fair crowd believes that he's a real boy when he's up there in harm's way. We know that his maker made him out of grief, but unlike Pinocchio, David is a product intended for mass production. Investors got on board. What do the regular people aware of the robot child concept think about it? What did the market research turn up? What do they think about the fact that a robot child never ages? Why does that never come up in the movie as a potential problem for this product? What happens when your consumer is no longer a 35-year-old who couldn't conceive and live out their fantasy of parenting a sweet little angel, and now they're 80 and need help going to the bathroom and getting their estate in order, and they've still got a 10-year-old kid frozen inside the exact same emotional needs, needs that cannot change and develop, and that because of the imprinting protocol are needs that only the designated parent can fulfill? Speaking of that, why does the father not do the imprinting? Is it mom's only? All these questions and many more are ignored so that Spielberg can make David Pinocchio and remind you of it in as many ways as a movie without any nose growing can make possible. And for what? What does Pinocchio give Spielberg except a pre-selected iconography? The association doesn't shake anything loose in your feelings, because Pinocchio is, like a lot of kids' stories, driven by an engine of moral instruction that doesn't apply here. Spielberg has kept a weak hold on Geppetto's grief, the other current in the story, but he's made the Pinocchio character blameless literally by design, and thus changed it into the story of a confused angel. So powerful is his programmed response to losing the parent who imprinted on him that he has no agency. He's not supposed to learn anything the way Pinocchio did, and he can't, and he doesn't. Spielberg doesn't use this story of a robot who can love to give us any new perspectives on love, precisely because it's the love of a child for a parent that David is programmed to emulate, and that's a kind of love that is total and impermeable, not open to question. So once we have lost the mother's perspective and we're riding on David's shoulders, all Spielberg can do is keep restating the rejected child premise that we started with, to the exclusion of anything else he might do with it, like develop it, expand it, complicate it, give it resonance. It's just the single note of a lonely little boy's sadness ringing deafeningly throughout all. David's software seemed pretty advanced to me. How come his story can't take us to more interesting places? Is the fact that he isn't interesting what gives him away as an artificial child? There's nothing to stick around for. On both viewings, I have lost all interest in David's suffering by the time he encounters his Geppetto and William Hurt, and am hopelessly exasperated by the time we learn from the alien's pleasant baritone that Mom can be resurrected from the lock of hair that a certain smart teddy bear kept in a little rip in his fabric for no reason, but that, oh no, she can only live for one day, because those are the rules for making an audience cry. Speaking of which, John Williams does too much again here on this one, but on the other hand, I am glad that Janusz Kaminski had the job to prove what a fine fit his blown-out cinematography was for sci-fi. He flew very close to the same style on Minority Report, and that one, at least, was a good time. I'll say this for The Flesh Fair, it is the most John Carpenter thing Spielberg ever shot. Also, it involves Al Jorgensen. Number 31, Always, 1989. Screenplay by Jerry Belson. From the screenplay, A Guy Named Joe, written by Dalton Trumbo. From an original story by Chandler Sprague and David Baim, with adaptation by Frederick Hazlitt Brennan. This remake of A Guy Named Joe, in which a dead pilot's spirit becomes earthbound until he can steer his grief-stricken widow into a new romance with a new pilot, is the hokiest thing Steven Spielberg ever attached himself to, which of course is one hell of a distinction. Once that incredible opening shot is over and the characters start talking, you immediately feel a diabetic coma setting in. I love a movie that brings out my inner sap, but this marches fiercely past sappy into stupid, and is so committed to its stupidity that I can't imagine any viewer letting themselves get involved without feeling debased. The stupidity infects everything, from the greater story arc to the rules governing Pete's involvement as a spirit, but it's most powerfully demonstrated by the construction of Ted, who goes miles beyond lovable dummy. Besides not being lovable, he's so dumb he needs to be under supervision. That is, until the plot has decided that he needs to suddenly pull himself together, at which time he does, though he fails to become interesting in the process. The early scenes are set at this firefighter's HQ that is like a photo negative of the bar in Only Angels Have Wings. Everybody in this one is a dork. And the way we discover who the two main characters are is by the way the entire world stops every time either of them says or does anything. Pauline Kael said something in her review of McCabe and Mrs. Miller about how Robert Altman directed that movie's Community so organically and fluidly that you felt the camera might break off and follow someone else at any moment. Something of the same could be said for Only Angels Have Wings, even though it necessarily had a more carefully engineered plot. But in this movie you get the exact opposite sense, that if Richard Dreyfuss and Holly Hunter were to skip town, the 50 or so colleagues they left behind would simply evaporate. Everyone else is a figurant who exists only to observe these two. This is the first clue as to the choking cuteness, and it will be followed by everything else in the movie. Dreyfuss is almost hilariously wrong for the part, which calls for cool confidence, not snide and anxious superiority. Hunter is brilliant and completely without vanity, as usual. I don't for an instant begrudge this casting director watching Raising Arizona and pointing to Hunter and John Goodman and saying, "Gimme them two." But even good performances amount to little when a story is this precision machined and every line of dialogue and physical gag is insufferable sitcom horse pucky. Goodman's character sticks a straw into a Twinkie at one point. This is as fair a representation of the film's sense of humor as anything else. Even if it weren't a remake of A Guy Named Joe, every story development would still be insultingly obvious. And the way I know this is I haven't seen A Guy Named Joe. Number 30, 1941, 1979. Screenplay by Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis from a story by John Milius, Bob Gale, and Robert Zemeckis. The zany one about an alternate Hollywood tearing itself to shreds in the titular year after Pearl Harbor gets all of Southern California in a tizzy about a possible Japanese attack along the coast. Agonizing. One could choose to catalog its hundreds of failures, but dive into a pool this shallow and all you're going to get is your head busted open. The only thing it knows how to do is noisily destroy things. It's desperate from the word go, and it never stops. Explosions ring out all through the closing credits. The embarrassment brought on by this onslaught of unfunniness is always doubled every time you remember that Toshiro Mifune is in it. I can scarcely believe this is the same writing team that pulled off the evilly brilliant Used Cars just 1 year later, nor that Spielberg's comic instincts were ever this bad. I will tack on a half star for the sequence of the tank and the paint factory, because that is the only moment when the movie's appetite for destruction becomes self-aware. Number 29, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, 2008. Screenplay by David Koepp, from a story by George Lucas and Jeff Nathanson, based on characters created by George Lucas and Philip Kaufman. I'll be honest, I haven't seen this one since the theater in 2008, and don't remember it terribly well, and don't want to. What I mostly do remember is that it distinguishes itself from the other Indiana Jones movies by having aliens in it. I also remember the fridge explosion and a little of Cate Blanchett in a Nazi uniform and way too much of Shia LaBeouf, any amount of whom is too much. The feeling I remember taking away from it at the time was that it powerfully did not work, and that this was due to a combination of the specific failings of this week's Screen story and the onset of fandom cancer, and had nothing to do with the narrative that prevailed as we went in, which was about Harrison Ford being too old. Sure, he was more checked out in this one, but that wasn't about him being old. He had started checking out in about 1982, and it was pretty much a linear decline. The trouble here was that this just didn't have the sparkle of the original indie trilogy. There was a rush in the original movies that was about extending the lineage of old adventure serials, and the attempted rush here is about extending the lineage of Indiana Jones. That is the moment when Hollywood IP becomes decadent, when it starts looking that big in the mirror. Number 28, The Color Purple, 1985, screenplay by Menno Meyes from the novel by Alice Walker. This screenplay is chock-a-block with baffling errors, like the baby born one season earlier being 7 months old, and Albert somehow detecting the presence of a letter from Suge in his mailbox by psychic premonition, and transitioning from 1909 to 1916, and from Deseretta Jackson to Whoopi Goldberg, by having Seeley read the same page of Oliver Twist, and making Suge the preacher's daughter to force a sacred-slash-profane music angle. The word contrived is too mild for the musical merger scene in which this culminates, and caring nothing for Squeak, and Sophia being rendered a zombie by her attack and then being cured in an instant, and racing through Nettie's whole life in Africa in a single scene so that the ending seems like an afterthought. But just as baffling as any of these problems is the tone, which flows straight out of Spielberg's insistence in what should be a serious and patient drama about the relationship between a person's inner life and the place that holds them, on chasing after the same suspense and comedy effects that constituted his comfort zone at the time. Rather than grow into a story like this, he makes quasi-set pieces, inflating everything to ridiculous proportions, and getting more than a little assistance in this from Quincy Jones's awful trumped-up score, which is like the glaze on the ham. Alice Walker's novel is unimaginative and didactic, but it at least finds some real emotional desolation in Seeley's loneliness. Spielberg reduces everything, every last thing, to soap opera or slapstick. Goldberg and Danny Glover are both totally committed and their gifts shine through plain enough, but they're serving a stumpy vision, two-dimensional source material reduced from two to one. It does become wonderful for a fleeting moment when Suge sings to Seeley and makes her blush. Whoopi Goldberg's abashed wet eyes are a deeply moving sight, and the film has finally gotten under her skin here. Now, this is something the movie hasn't managed to build up to. The development of this relationship is one of the things the book does a good job of, and the screenplay skips over all the bonding between the two women that clears the road for this. Still, the tender, quiet feeling it finds in this scene is the one thing the movie gets right, and it abandons it as quickly as it can. Number 27, Ready Player One, 2018, screenplay by Zach Penn and Ernest Cline from the novel by Ernest Cline. The one where the dead near-future designer who designed the totalizing dystopian virtual gaming space left Easter eggs scattered around that, if found, will grant total control of the space and the underlying company to the gamer who finds them. And how a whole new profession, basically a replacement for all of academia, is spun up to study the pop culture that the dead designer was obsessed with in hopes of teasing out clues as to where those Easter eggs might be buried. Ultimately, it's about how pop culture, but specifically only the Gen X pop culture that laid the groundwork for the capital N nerd culture industry of today, is a holy text. It is an amazing movie, but not the good kind of amazing. What makes it amazing is its sheer deadness and its commitment to deadness. Since most of it takes place inside an immersive game, it is the craziest visual whirlwind that Spielberg ever cooked up. But it all exists to serve worshipfully the idea that there are no new ideas. It's a corpse made up of pieces of other corpses, a Frankenstein's monster that nobody even attempted to bring to life. Like, let me just ask you this. The ideal viewer for the Shining sequence is someone who has seen The Shining multiple times, right? That sequence is the epitome of fan service. But can you imagine any sincere fan of The Shining liking it more after seeing what this movie did to it? The familiar sets overtaken by video game avatars spouting the blank dross that is the contemporary equivalent of wisecracks? The character known as H confronts the woman in the room 237 bathtub and says, "Oh, hi, naked lady. I don't mean to interrupt your bath time. I know self-care can be important." What could this possibly do to anyone's associations with The Shining except erode and cheapen them? Number 26, Hook, 1991, screenplay by Malia Scotch Marmo and Jim V. Hart, from a screen story by Jim V. Hart and Nick Castle, based on Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie. I didn't get around to rewatching this one from my youth, but as I recall, it's about Peter Pan if he did in fact grow up and became an uptight corporate guy, but then was called back to Never Never Land later on for some reason, even though Peter Pan is usually the one who does the calling, and he rediscovers his true self and the experience teaches him about being nicer to his kids. I mostly remember being just old enough to be thinking about how weird it was that Peter Pan even could grow up, let alone forget everything about who he used to be, let alone become a better father to his kids by regressing to childhood himself. That seems like the crucial and original idea in the movie, and it's a pretty blurry one. I was also just getting deep enough into movies to also find it weird that it was Dustin Hoffman up there as Captain Hook. In what universe is that actor delivering the appropriate energy for that role? I also wondered why they named the movie after Hook instead of Peter Pan. It's not like a retelling from Hook's perspective or anything, nor does Hook work as some larger metaphor. And now that I'm tunneling back into this memory of sitting in that movie theater, I think the death of Rufio also marked the first time I remember realizing in the moment that a movie was trying to manipulate me. What I don't remember is an overall feeling, which since I was an 11-year-old boy, i.e. the exact viewer that the movie was made for, probably indicates that the experience was just as confused and forced and mawkish as it seems to me now as I try to piece it back together. These unfortunately were not uncommon problems for Robin Williams' vehicles, regardless of director. And it's a funny kind of flop for Spielberg, in that he himself is the Peter Pan of the movies. In general, he is never better than when using his camera to express the wonder and amazement of a child. But when his movies go wrong, it's usually because they imposed a child's attitude onto material that wouldn't accept it. What he's trying to do here is express the wonder and amazement of a 40-year-old Robin Williams as he learns that the best way for him to raise his children is to become them. That ties the classic Spielberg problems into a tight little knot, doesn't it? He may have been too close to this material to be able to see it. Number 25, The Adventures of Tintin, 2011, screenplay by Edgar Wright, Joe Cornish, and Stephen Moffat from the comics by Hergé. This is the one that used motion capture and computer animation to pay tribute to the Hergé Tintin comics with a look that basically did not resemble the look of those comics at all. It's not that it looks too creepy per se. The skinned mocap isn't the oppressive nightmare of the Polar Express, besides which that movie didn't have the likes of an Andy Serkis to draw on. It's that it looks just creepy enough to continually bring you back to question its appearance when you're trying to figure out why it's so joyless. Ultimately, the connection between those two qualities is not as simple as that. For one thing, Spielberg manages some really ambitious visual gags. It wouldn't surprise me if he'd used this project as an opportunity to cross off longtime wish list shots and transitions that could only have been managed in animation, of which the colossal one-shot chase through Bagar is merely the most spectacular. But these gags are what we must rely on for all the delights. The script has so little juice to show for its three credited writers. The Thompson and Thompson material given to Simon Pegg and Nick Frost is particularly unbearable. I spent a lot of the movie thinking not about Spielberg's career, but about Edgar Wright's. And what little Hergé verisimilitude the animation style can claim to achieve comes at the cost of expressiveness. This is a movie, and that trade goes against the strengths of the medium. Number 24, Amistad, 1997, screenplay by David Franzoni. Yeah, I don't remember this one very well either. It's nominally about the incident in 1839 when the captives on a Spanish slave ship called La Amistad seized control of the ship in a mutiny and then docked in the United States, making the slaves' legal status a matter for the Supreme Court to decide. I recall it being a lot of liberal self-backpatting about the deep roots of American racism, culminating in a big speech from Anthony Hopkins as John Quincy Adams about how freedom is good and important. That's basically the best I could do. I could have rewatched it, but, I mean, would you want to? Number 23, The BFG, 2016, screenplay by Melissa Matheson from the novel by Roald Dahl. This is kind of a tough one to chew. The final shot did bring a tear to my eye, which for me is proof that Mark Rylance was exactly the actor for the job and that mocap is better than ever at face stuff. But the rest of the movie feels awkward. Scene after scene reminds you of the story as written by Dahl because it highlights the precise ways in which that story is inappropriate to the film medium. It's a story too light and loose, even by Roald Dahl standards, for a movie treatment. To depict these things at all on film is to take them embarrassingly seriously. Spielberg has always been a literalist, so he might have been a particularly poor fit for the project, even though he is also typically at his best when he is telling a story of wonder and amazement through the eyes of a child. The magic never arrives here, though. It's not bad, but it gets nowhere near the delights it's constantly gunning for, even when the dream chasing is afoot. By the time we get to Buckingham Palace, it's just a parade of gags about how big our guy is. Bit of a shame. Number 22, Disclosure Day, 2026, screenplay by David Koepp from a story by Steven Spielberg, talked about this one last week. Number 21, and the last one we'll be talking about today, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, 1997, screenplay by David Koepp, based on characters created by Michael Crichton. I haven't seen this since the first run either, and can only think of Janine Garofalo's bit about it in her HBO special from later that year, where I think in reference to the Vince Vaughn character, she starts doing a guy who goes, "Woo, yeah, dinosaurs, I'm the dreamer." And she does finger quotes for the dreamer. And then she says, "Whenever the dreamer shows up, Garofalo's gotta go." I have no thoughts of my own on the subject. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.